Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that'll determine what the future will bring. And I need to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views, and for the next hour, they're going to be the views of David Sibley from Ready Reserve Food, who we work with. Ready Reserve Food's been around for 40 years or so. David owned it for about 11 years, and of course, they make long-term dehydrated food, and of course, it's packed in nitrogen for setting aside. But before we get into a discussion of what's happening as far as food is concerned here in the United States and throughout the world, I want to just mention an excellent website. I hope you'll go there. It's called The Daily Paul. It's simply www.dailypaul.com. And, of course, that is the website for Ron Paul. And you will find there a speech that he gave on the 26th of June, just 2 days ago. I guess it was just yesterday, where Congressman Paul, addressing an empty chamber there of Congress, is talking about, well, the fact, of course, that oil has hit an all-time high, that the dollar is progressively falling, that the government is intentionally creating all sorts of inflation here. Of course, they're not telling you that, but it's the Federal Reserve System that has introduced an additional $4 trillion into the marketplace over the last couple of years. And it is this that, of course, is destroying the value of our currency. But the reason this is an important talk is because Congressman Paul is pointing out that after the 5th of July, legislation will be coming to the floor of the House of Representatives and will probably pass, where the Congress is authorizing the President of the United States to monitor all traffic, all transportation, all goods going into Iran, and to restrict the ability of Iranian officials traveling throughout the world. Now, ladies and gentlemen, if somebody was monitoring and restricting the access we had to goods, if somebody was controlling the travel of our diplomats and government officials, that would be an act of war. And this is an act of war. And this is what Congressman Paul is inferring, that this is certainly going to lead to increased possibility of imminent hostilities with Iran. Go to the website Daily Paul. You can actually Google that in if you have a computer, or you can simply go to www.dailypaul.com and listen before you go to bed tonight, or certainly first thing in the morning, to Congressman Paul's speech on the 26th of June. Listen to what he has to say, and then help us get the word out. And write to your congressman, call your congressman, email your congressman, fax your congressman, and tell him to vote no on this resolution, that we will begin to restrict Iran's access to material, that all of it will be monitored by the United States, and we will begin to prevent and block the travel of Iranian officials. Ladies and gentlemen, the last thing we want is another war, and yet, of course, it appears that it is imminent. And if it happens, it will be with the consent of our Congress, and that's unconscionable. And you'd better let them know that with elections coming up, you're going to remember in November just how they vote on this resolution. Well, with that as a background, let's go to our special guest this evening, David Sibley of Ready Reserve Food, because David's been in the food business for a long period of time. And really for years he's been calling me, telling me that people weren't making any preparations. Recently, people are beginning to make some preparations. They know something big is in the offing. Certainly we know that the bee population, the bee colonies, about 35% of bee colonies in the United States have just collapsed. The bees leave the hive and they never find their way back. And then, of course, we're having real problems with the corn crop this year, as the vast majority of it is being destroyed by the floods, and we're going to be back with all of these issues and really what's going to be happening to food prices in the coming year. Well, David, how are you this evening?
Fine, Doctor. How are you today?
I'm doing fine. Certainly, things don't look very good for that corn crop in the Middle West, do they?
No, it's gone. It's underwater, and if it's 300 miles to the west, I was talking to a gentleman that came in from Missouri, you'll see things destroyed and underwater and flooded, and then things will be destroyed because there's a drought. It's silly. There's way too much water over here and not enough water over here.
Yeah, it's almost as if somebody was interfering with the weather patterns, isn't it? Like somebody maybe was intentionally interfering with the weather patterns, and some place you're having flooded, and other places you're having droughts. Sort of like Zygmunt Brzezinski wrote in his book, which incidentally is obviously being suppressed because it's very difficult to get up on Amazon, but the book Between Two Ages, written in 1970, where he talks in one of the footnotes about how in the future we're going to be able to we, mankind, governments, are going to be able to create storms and droughts, and that's sort of what we're having today, isn't it?
Yes.
I wonder why it's so difficult to get that book on Amazon, Between Two Ages by Zygmunt Brzezinski, who incidentally happens to be the man who got Jimmy Carter elected, the national security advisor to Jimmy Carter, who precipitated the Afghan War and this whole Islamic terrorist movement, and now he just happens to be, just by accident, the foreign policy advisor to the Barack Hussein Obama. Well, go right ahead, though. Well, you're just saying, of course, in some places there's too much water, some places there's too much, and all of this is influencing the crops.
Yes, and there is no backup. Americans are under the assumption there's just this cornucopia of silos and all this food that is in reserve. There is none.
Comes back. Basically, we've done away with all of our wheat supplies. We used to have 3 years' supply of wheat. We don't have 3 years' supply of wheat. We got maybe a few months' supply of wheat. And if the wheat crop doesn't come in, why, we're going to be in real trouble. What about the corn supplies? What about the soybean supplies and products like that? What's happening to rice?
Okay, I talked to the folks in Arkansas today. I made a call.
That's the rice capital.
They managed to get a rice crop in that part of Arkansas. That's all they would tell me. They said it should be fairly good, but you know the rice crop does not a complete year make. So they managed to pull. They got in way late. Let's see what the yield is. But let's see. You know that's one potentially a fair, well, shall we say, in baseball, a double. Okay, what we need is several home runs just to make up the gap. And then I guess in some of the areas that the water's receded, they don't have time enough to grow corn, but they will be growing soy. It'll grow a little faster.
All right, for our listeners out there, this is David Sibley, and David was saying that at least in one area of Arkansas, they said they were going to have a pretty good rice crop. Will that be up to normal rice crop, do you think? Or?
They wouldn't say. They were elusive. So that tells me it's going to be at best okay, shall we say, or fair. Bumper crop, I don't think so.
All right. Now, what about, you were just saying then, Chris, that the, what about the corn crop? We know that's going to be badly damaged.
Oh, it's gone. The vast majority of the corn crop in this country is gone. It's washed away.
Drowned,
and in the beginning of its life, it didn't get drowned. It was pretty wet, and we discussed this before, where the root ball, because it doesn't have to struggle for water, its root ball becomes kind of small. Well, then in the late months, July and August, if it happens to get very dry, which it probably going to, in other words, it doesn't have the root system to support itself, and the crop is stunted on in that regard. In other words, the corn is going to survive. A good portion of it is probably going to be pretty limited in its output.
Well, of course, the old adage used to be the corn crop was to be knee-high by the 4th of July. Unfortunately, the crops that are getting in and getting in late, of course, are going to be just little tiny plants when August comes and the heat comes, and it'll just dry them out. I know my cousin's a professor of agriculture, very concerned about what future as far as the corn crop this year.
Well, it's weird. There are no disasters. Something that came to my mind today. Doc, do you remember the Symbionese Liberation Army, Patty Hearst,
sure.
that that big row back in those days. Well, the Symbionese Liberation Army, one of their political demands was to release food to the poor in the inner cities from the strategic reserve. And if, I don't know if you remember, where truckloads of cheese and items were taken to the inner city and dispersed to people, and they had big riots over it, you know, people fighting over it. But that's where that food came from, was from our strategic reserves. This radical political group, they didn't think it was fair, and they may have had a point, that all people should go hungry when the government has food stored in food lockers, silos, and even in caves, because they would, in the past, they would buy product from the farm in a form of price support to keep the price up. Well, then they came around and got rid of that program, and what they did is they just paid farmers not to grow anything. It was easier. Then they didn't have to store it. But the problem was is that eliminated that option of having things in storage. And we're there. We are there. And the gross mismanagement on our leaders' part is when we just put so much effort into growing corn for ethanol. Before we did that, somebody should have stepped back and says, you know, global demand for all kinds of farm products is going up. We need to fill up the silos and the caves and in the lockers again before we commit so much of this land to ethanol, growing corn for ethanol. But they didn't. Well, it's caught up with us now. We've been stung. We've been stung very hard, and the average person doesn't know about it yet. They know something's wrong, but they do not know what's coming. There is no reserves, folks. That's all I can tell you.
What about wheat now? Of course, wheat is the staff of life, and we've always had plenty of wheat here. What about our wheat supplies, and what's happening throughout the rest of the world as far as wheat and corn is concerned? You know,
I was reading a newspaper from Kansas. The wheat, again, has been affected a lot by areas that had just had too much rain. The wheat is stunted, low yields. Some farms, they were in the trail end of the article, they were talking about farmers reporting only 5 to 8 bushels of wheat per acre. Well, that's not making it. I don't know how much of the harvest was at that yield, but they're getting 40 to 60 bushels pretty much on an average, which is down substantially. And the bushel wasn't making quite to 60 pounds. It was in the high 50s. So the quality of the product is down. The quality and the size of the yield is down in a lot of areas on wheat. I mean, it just doesn't, bad weather on corn, I should say. It affects everything.
Well, if you're out there in the audience, maybe you're a farmer, maybe you can tell us what's happening in your area, would like to have to give us a call. But we do know that the wheat crop in Australia for the last 7 years has been limited because of the massive drought that they're having in Australia. We do know that the wheat crop in Africa and in Asia is limited because of the rust that they have that's growing on the wheat. So certainly, of course, Brazil is a large producer of wheat. We don't know too much about what's going on there, but we do know we do not have the supply of wheat. We do know that there are food riots throughout the world. We do know that the price of food is going up, and the price of wheat has gone up dramatically. The price of corn has gone up dramatically. The price of soybeans and rice. And we do know that at the local Costco stores, which we have here in California, and they may be in other parts of the country, there's a sign up that you can only buy rice according to your buying patterns of the past, or at least they do not want people, of course, to go in and buy a lot of rice. There obviously is some shortage, there's some shortfall as far as their ability to get it. Maybe they're afraid that people will panic and start buying up the rice, but they suggest that you buy according to your past habits. Now, of course, some Chinese restaurants have gone into Costco. They'll buy up, you know, a half a dozen bags of rice a week because they use it in their work and use it in the restaurants. And so the Costco would then, of course, continue to supply rice to them. But they don't want people just going in and buying large supplies of wheat for fear that this is going to, down the line, lead to real problems. So are you having any difficulty getting any of the food products at the present time?
Not at the moment. When I say difficulty, the time to get them is longer. Some products I used to be able to get from brokers and suppliers basically overnight. Now it takes weeks.
Now you're talking about powdered milk?
Powdered milk, for instance. That's the because we use a lot of it. It used to be I could call several brokers, and our product is basically just regular powdered milk. It's the way we can it. I could call midday on a Friday and have a truckload in front of the business by 10 o'clock Monday morning. Now it's about a 5 to 6 week wait.
All right. Why would that be? Why is there having problems getting powdered milk? Is there a shortage of it here in America? Is it being shipped overseas? Why are you having a difficulty getting it today?
Well, first off, one of the things that has happened is because of the government doesn't have it in strategic reserve, there's not. They've abandoned the ability to make copious amounts of it because the government doesn't buy it. So the production is limited. It's just-in-time production has gotten the, you know what just-in-time production is in industry where
right. All
the parts show up just at the right time so you don't inventory anything. Well, we've begun to do that to some extent with food. Well, that works not so bad when you have to shut down the plant that's making wash machines for a day because the motors didn't show up. But when you have to shut down the quote, system that supplies everybody with their daily substance that doesn't shut down, now we have a problem. It's back to what I said earlier about our leadership. It didn't think this through. I'm going to get in trouble for this, but it's almost like it was deliberate. You couldn't have messed this up any worse.
All right. Well, now what about such things like dried eggs, things like that?
Again, when they are inventoried, there's just a smaller inventory of them. What I'll end up doing is the dried eggs, again, are just off-the-shelf dried eggs, is one of the products is. They used to be everywhere. When I say everywhere, now what will happen is I'll order tons of them, and my orders are going up because we're getting more and more busy, because people are beginning to connect the dots and decide to store food, so my orders are getting bigger, and the lead time is getting longer to get the food. I'll call the supplier, and he'll supply me with a third of my order, and the rest of it will dribble in over the course of several weeks. So it's a strange situation. So what we've elected to do is increase our standing inventory by a very substantial amount to meet demand.
Well, what about the prices? Are the prices that you're being forced to pay going up?
Well, I got a fax today. Tomato powder, dried tomato powder, went up another 10% today. Bang, just like that, sitting on the fax. I happen to pick, it's not my job to control prices, but I happen to pick the fax up off the machine and scan the communique, and the prices are just, the wholesale price is just going up. And we just went through several, I remember, prices in tomatoes and tomato powder substantially over the last few months.
And, of course, this is not the first increase that you've had.
Oh, no, no. This is, I've become numb to it. And the increases seem to be substantial every time. It wasn't a 3 and 4% increase. Now they're 10, 12% at a whack. So inflation is here. And that's the other thing you need to tell your listeners is food is going to get so expensive. That it's going to take such a major majority of their budget between energy and food that a lot of the luxuries that we've been used to, entertainment and the like, are going to just go by the wayside. The energy and the money that you have available is going to have to be placed on the things that you need to have.
Well, now, I know you can't be exact on it, but let's say over the last couple of years, how much has tomato paste gone up? How much has rice gone up?
Rice has probably doubled.
Right,
and I don't control that or watch those numbers, but I'm going to guess it has doubled in the last. And the tomatoes, tomato powders, they're getting close. I think they've gone up. They used to be one of the more dried tomatoes used to be one of the more cheaper products. It was just everywhere. They've gone up, I would think, at least 60% in the last 2 years.
A cup telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY, 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or 464-8295. The people in Washington, D.C. tell us inflation is 2%, maybe 4% if we include food. And ladies and gentlemen, they're lying to you. They're lying because they don't want you to begin making preparation for the difficult times that lie ahead.
Oh, it's a mess.
Well, it's okay, fine. So certainly there's inflation. You can get the food at the present time. It's just more delayed as far as your access to getting it is concerned. What do you hear from other people that are in the food business? And what do we know about what's happening in other countries? Do we know very much about what's happening there?
Only what I can glean from the Internet. And that's funny you should say that, because it used to be easier to get what I considered reasonably accurate, or at least a thumbnail sketch of what's going on. It's like it got it clamped down all of a sudden. Information about the drought in Australia has literally dried up. There's an occasional blurb on it when you scour enough. They're having environmental problems. There's so little water that they're beginning to lose habitats. Their rice industry is over 99% defunct.
Australia, 99%?
Yeah, their rice production does not exist, because it's very water intensive to begin with. And along with their wheat, I don't know about their wheat, they may even have to be a net wheat importer. I've been looking for that information, where they used to be a net exporter, and other countries were regularly dependent upon their exports. For instance, Japan, dairy products in Japan are basically, in some areas, some products are non-existent because they were dependent. They don't have large grazing lands, so they got their dairy products from Australia, which is, you know, a fairly open and area where land is so expensive and limited in Japan. Well, their economy is suffering when it comes to certain products right now. There's shortages.
So, well, this is really sort of a worldwide phenomenon. I know in the third world countries there's terrible, terrible suffering, because you've got a lot of people, about a billion people who live on a dollar a day. And of course, you know, you double the cost of food. Why, of course, they just don't have enough food, money to buy the food.
Well, that's exactly what I was trying to say here. We're blessed. We generally have expendable money, and we spend it on things that are luxuries. They don't. They hit the wall early, but it's beginning to happen here. People don't have the extra money because their staples, their things they have to have, are going up. I was reading some articles about how people, their utilities are being turned off at record rates. Okay, you either put a roof over your head and feed yourself. Okay, we'll deal without having no electricity. They're limited on their funds, and it's here in America that this is happening.
All right, fine. Well, let's go to Jane, who's calling here from Sacramento. She'll be on the line in just a moment. And if you're out there in the listening audience, you'd like to give us a call, our number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY, 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or 464-8295. Hi, Jane. How are you doing?
Oh, good, good. I missed being able to listen to you for a long time. Our computer was out. So glad to be back.
Well, we've been here all the time. Do you listen to us on shortwave or the Internet?
Well, don't have a shortwave yet. That's probably our next move.
All right, fine.
Just had a question. You know, I guess mentioned that it seems almost deliberate, and of course I do believe it is, but do you guys feel that it's also deliberate, that it's just really hard to inexpensively purchase the other nutritious grains like the spelt and camut and quinoa and all of the other grains?
Hold that thought. I'll be back in just a moment. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our telephone number, 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. Our guest this evening is David Sibley of Ready Reserve Food. And we have Jane calling from Sacramento. And you were asking about the other grains. What were the specific grains were you thinking of?
Well, the other alternative grains. When you go and shop for them, it's not that you can't find them, but you just can't buy them in the same quantity.
You're talking about,
and if
what's
you try
this?
To buy brown rice.
Oh, brown rice, okay.
You know, that's another thing, is you can find enough white rice if you want to get a 50-pound bag of white rice. But what I'm saying is, that doesn't it seem rather deliberate also that they seem to make it harder for you to purchase the more nutritious products?
Some of that was market dynamics. other crops, now, this is not wholly the case, but it contributed to it. Other crops became very lucrative. Corn, for instance, because of the subsidies on corn. So a lot of people that may have grown certain the smaller, the spelts and the rices and stuff, they converted to corn. The farmer's a businessman. If he can make more money growing this versus this, he tends to go to that. So that's one of them. And the other one is those products, again, foreigners, you cannot believe how large the force is of foreigners buying up our crops. They're not even out of the ground. And then ratcheting the price up, loading it on ships and taking it out of the country. And our leadership should have shut that off, basically before last spring. But they didn't.
All right. So basically, Jane, of course, the prices are just going up, and I think the food is going to become harder and harder and far more expensive to get now as time goes by. So if there's any way you can make your preparations now, and whether you get it from David or ourselves, or just go down to Costco and start getting your staple foods there. I know I've talked to David about, putting rice, for instance, into 5-gallon buckets. He says it's too expensive. It's too expensive to ship. You'll be better off going to Costco now. If you want to get it number 10 tin cans, packed in nitrogen, that's what they specialize in. But a lot of these things you want to buy in bulk yourself and put away, and then the other specialty items are things that would be more palatable, the tomato powder, and certainly the apples and the raisins and the fruit cocktail, all of these dehydrated, then, of course, you can get through him. Anything else you wanted to say, Jane?
Well, I was just wondering, these other grains like spelt and millet and those more unusual things.
You're talking about millet now.
So what you're saying, you just can't buy those big bags the way you can with rice.
Right.
They were reasonably limited to begin with. And now that there's so much pressure on the main staples, and as I mentioned before, the market dynamics, people are what little there was, they've used it up or have made it harder to get. And Stan just said something about Costco. If you don't buy from him or Ready Reserve, stockpile food, but you got to be the first one now, because once everybody, just a small percentage of 1% of people begin to take heed, it's over. There's not enough food. In other words, I would estimate that there's less than 0.01% of 1%, and it's probably 1/10 of that food available for everyone to stock up enough food in the next 3 months to get themselves through a year. It's not there. The system, even in good times, couldn't handle it. We knew that in Y2K, that when just a very small percentage of people began to push a just-in-time supply system, which we had back then the system couldn't keep up. So can you imagine what it's going to be like when just about everybody and their dog wants to do it all at once? This is why you've got to be now. Act now, and here it is. Here comes the Dr. Stan and Dave Sibley guarantee. If we're wrong, you can eat the food.
All right, anything else, Jane?
No, that was it. I was just wondering about some of those other things.
Right.
They're really hard to find.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
You might be able to get them, say, at Dave, could you get those at a farm supply place? Where would you get them?
Oh, that's a good question. Where have I seen it? Well, actually, they used to sell it at Costco. But I haven't seen it there in a long time. But then again, I've been so busy. I haven't been out to Costco's in a long time.
Okay.
Costco does things. They sell large amounts of spices, peppers and spices and chilies and stuff in these fairly tall plastic industrial size restaurant, institutional size stuff. You need to start stockpiling that, because the quality of the food that you're going to get, you're going to have to start spicing up your foods here and hiding them in spices to make them more palatable, because the quality of them is going to begin to diminish if I don't miss my bet.
Oh, that thought would be right back here. Well, this is Dr. Stan Becker at Radio Liberty. Our guest this evening is David Sibley of Ready Reserve Foods. And certainly he's on the front lines of this battle because that's what he does for a living. And, of course, not only we work with David, but we talk off the air very frequently about what's going on in the world. And there's so many things that are happening that as far as food is concerned, but, of course, the government, the people who control our reality through control of the media, want to focus our attention on all sorts of nonsensical things. What it gets us watching television where they're debating things that have absolutely no consequence, and they'll have two people shouting at one another. They call it shout television, but it really, of course, is an effort to distract you, and of course you get an emotional high hearing all this yelling and screaming and fussing, but it is really to keep you from being able to think and think effectively about the very real problems that we face in society. So if you're out there...
You said something about thinking and thinking effectively.
Right.
Maybe not your listeners, but there is such a large section, a large cross-section of our population that cannot no longer think effectively. And that's the frightening part. These people, they're pathetic, Stan, in their logic system, and they're dangerous when they get scared. That's why... you and I have talked about me relocating my family and business to another place. Well, tomorrow morning I get on an airliner to fly to this place, and I'm going to look at another farm. I'm getting out. I'm getting out of Dodge. This is the last place I want to be when all this goes down. So I'm making, not to brag, but I practice what I preach. The times are getting tough, and I'm relocating my family.
Now, you, of course, live in Southern California now, is that right?
Right.
And I can understand why you would want to get away from Southern California.
I live in Southern California.
And, of course, with what you do, of course, you could actually move your location any place. You can, as long as you have access to trucking, why, of course, you can always have the things brought in, and then you can truck them out from there. Because for our listeners who don't know anything about Ready Reserve Food, they're a major wholesaler and as well as a retailer. And you can go up on the Internet, and there are a lot of people who sell food who get their food from David Sibley. They act just as basically as we do as a retailer for David's products. But I said you can get them through him, you can get them through us. If you get them through us, you help Radio Liberty. But be that as it may, the important thing is that David can go anywhere in the country and get his food products out. As long as the food products are available, as long as people have the money to buy them. But we're moving into very, very difficult times.
People don't. That's the people do not have the money. People are broke. And the food is starting to get harder to get.
This is Dr. Stan here. Our guest is David Sibley of Ready Reserve Foods. If you're out there in the listening audience, you have a question or comment, our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY, 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or 464-8295. And, David, do you have a website you'd like to put out there?
ReadyReserveFoods.com.
ReadyReserveFoods.com. Of course, if you'd like a catalog for Ready Reserve Foods, why, you can give us a call. We'll be glad to get one off to you. But we think it's vitally important that people begin making preparations, not only preparation for food, but preparation for water. You need to be able to purify your water. That's why you need to have access to, I believe, the Berkey units are as good as anything you're going to find. What's interesting is they're having a terrible time meeting their orders. In fact, right now, they're just today beginning to actually ship their orders for the Berkey filters from the middle of May, so they're way behind. Why? Because more and more people know that something is amiss, and they're beginning to look for supplies of water. David's seeing that impact, I know.
Oh, yeah.
Because, of course, as far as he's concerned, your business has doubled or tripled here in the last few months?
Oh, in the last 90 days, it's by a factor of 10.
Really?
Yes, it's going vertical. That's another problem. I mean, your listeners or people that want, they'll get information, they'll sit on it and sit on it. And then it's like somebody opens a floodgate. Well, our production and supplies and supply lines is quantifiable. It's limited, all right? But then it's back then everybody and their brother wants what we make, and we can't keep up. This is why I urge your listeners, and so are you, to get prepared now. And it comes with that guarantee. If we're wrong, you can eat the food. But if we're right, you're going to be glad you listened to this program. And the government could use this as a weapon or a control, is food.
Of course, they do that in many countries throughout the world, for instance.
This is I talk to many people all day long. I like to talk to farmers and people that in production, because then I get it right from literally the horse's mouth, because they're the guys out on the front lines. I don't have to read it or get somebody else's take on it. I get it from the guy that's making it. But I had a customer, wasn't a farmer, explained something that never occurred to me about Walmarts. He said, this is his read, and it kind of makes sense. Walmarts, you go into a Walmart, they'll have 24 checkout stands, but only two or three at any given time are open. When they're real busy, five or six. During Christmas, maybe eight or nine. But the rest of them are still closed. And I was sitting there, yeah? He said, well, that's terrible marketing. That stuff is never open. You need to use that as merchandising space. He says, what that's there for, and this is his take on it, he said it occurred to him, they'll be used as national distribution centers for food. That's what all that extra stuff, according to this fella, was. And I thought, well, it fits, doesn't it? And how strategic Walmarts are, they're placed, and their relationship with the government, and I never thought of it that way, how a Walmart could be easily converted to a national distribution center, and they'll need that for checkout and control.
All right, our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY, 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or 464-8295, and people cannot believe we could ever have famine in America. And yet, of course, if you believe the Bible, as I do, and you read Revelation 6-8 about the four horsemen of the apocalypse, and, of course, the fourth horseman, the rider of the pale horse, of course, was going to kill a quarter of the population of the world by war. And, of course, if you go to the website we gave you earlier today in this program, the Daily Paul, and listen to Congressman Ron Paul on the 26th, just yesterday, giving a speech to an empty congressional hall, talking about, the very fact that everything points to the fact that we are on the verge of war with Iran, and then, of course, with pestilence and with famine, with disease and famine. And we keep hearing about the possibility of major world epidemics, new types of illnesses that nobody's ever seen before. We find increasingly the bacteria that will no longer respond to antibiotics. We've got real problems in the world. People say, oh, well, that's just pure talk. But is it possible that we would see during our lifetimes, perhaps much sooner than most people believe, the approach of the four horsemen of the apocalypse with death following close behind? Because that's what the Bible predicts. And there's just so many strange things happening today that you're not really hearing about. The average individual doesn't understand that the government has the ability to modify the weather. And it's all top secret. You cannot get this information, even under the Freedom of Information Act. Why, if they're not doing anything, why would they keep it secret? Well, the governments operate in secret because they don't want Osama bin Laden to find out what's going on. After all, over there in that cave in Pakistan, if he knew what the government was doing with the weather here, why, he might use that to take away our freedom. Well, I believe we've got very, very real problems because, and we'll talk at the end of the program if you want to verify what we're saying. There even legislation have come out, and the Congress recently about monitoring the weather modification programs of our own government. And then, of course, the HAARP program, the High Altitude Auroral Research Project, can alter the jet streams. We are having the strangest weather in California I've ever seen. There are over 1,100 fires here in the state of California. There's so many fires that some of them, they're not even bothering to try to fight. Today, of course, the sky was covered with fog and smoke, and something very strange is happening to our weather. And the question is, why? And why does the government keep what it's doing secret from the American people? Let's go to Sonny, who's calling from Washington. Hi, Sonny. Whereabouts do you live up there?
Oh, I live in the middle of the desert up here in Moses Lake.
All right, fine. Do you have a question or comment?
I do. I've heard you mention nitrogen, packing food in nitrogen.
Right.
Can you explain this?
Well, I can't, but I'll tell you. David simply can. You go ahead, David.
Okay, well, when you put a food, the oxygen... You there?
Go ahead.
Okay, oxygen, everything oxidizes. Rust is oxidation. Your food breaks down, it's oxidized. When you burn gasoline, it oxidizes very rapidly when you burn it. That's the nature of things. So what we want to do in storing food is to stop or greatly slow the oxidation process. So without oxygen, oxidation is really severely hampered. So we place the food in an inert, dry nitrogen atmosphere. So that does several things. It's dry. There's no moisture. Cause that's the other thing that's needed for this oxidation, the breakdown of the food. And there is no oxygen. And it also, any bacteria or anything that can't live in it, it's too dry and no oxygen. So it stabilizes the food and it has a long shelf life. It's been going on for 100 years, this process of nitrogen packing food, and they've got other systems now, oxygen absorbers. But why reinvent the wheel? Because I have a long proven history of how well nitrogen packing works.
And they use dry ice. I didn't realize that they use dry ice to actually do that. Is that right?
Dry ice is frozen carbon dioxide. Yes. And it is an inert gas, and you could do the same with nitrogen, replace the nitrogen with carbon dioxide and get the same effect. The thing is with carbon dioxide is it reacts to temperature a little more than nitrogen. In other words, it'll expand more. That's like, for instance, when you see the look down at a valve stem on a car, and the cars now, if you see a green valve stem on a car, that tire's been filled with nitrogen. And it's the new thing now, and NASCAR and race cars have been doing it for a long time, many years. And as the tire heats up on the race course, the nitrogen does not expand nearly as much as, just say, regular atmospheric oxygen. And the tire doesn't change characteristics. In other words, it's more stable to heat. And CO2, carbon dioxide, is not quite as or nearly as stable as nitrogen. That's why it's preferred.
And so you actually pack in nitrogen.
In nitrogen, yes.
Does that answer your question, Sunny?
It does. It does. So any food that we're going to be storing should be packed in nitrogen.
The difference is somewhat subtle. In other words, the food you're going to be storing, I pack for about a 15-year shelf life. You're probably not going to go out that far. You can use CO2. Take a small, maybe between half and this, or the size of a cigarette pack of dry ice, which is nothing more than frozen CO2, and place it in the bottom of your container. Like I'm talking about a 5 or 6 gallon bucket. Place your grains that you're going to be storing on top of it. And put the lid, just lay the lid of this bucket on there, and allow that thing to sit for several hours and let that the CO2 melt, gasify. It's heavy, it's dense, it'll displace all the oxygen, and you'll have a nitrogen atmosphere, an inert atmosphere, CO2, in a couple hours, and then you just gently, without trying to disturb this gas that's in there, just place the lid on and stamp it down. You end up doing what I do in an industrial process very slowly. I do it 36 cans at a time, just boom, 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 boom. You do it like one bucket or two buckets or five buckets at a time in your living room or your den, wherever you elect to do this.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So it's the same process. It's just with a different gas, and instead of it being held in tanks, it's basically frozen, and this dry ice melts. We've all seen dry ice melt. And to ensure that the atmosphere has been pushed out, the oxygen, when you think the process is complete, light a match and lay it in over the top of your grain. If the oxygen has been displaced, the match goes out. It works quite well. I've done it many times myself.
Okay, Sunny. Thank you.
Well, thank you.
Is there anything else you'd like to ask?
Well, I was just going to recap, just to make sure that I understand, and that's a small piece of dry ice in the bottom of a 5 to 6 gallon bucket.
All right.
Pack the items on top of it. Pack them pretty dense.
Let's pick on grain because it's real easy to visualize.
Okay.
You fill it up with, it's on the bottom.
Uh-huh.
You fill the bucket up with grain.
Okay.
Now this frozen piece of dry ice is down at the bottom of this grain. And it'll freeze burn that grain just a little bit in that area where it's contacting.
Uh-huh.
But the ambient heat will eventually cause the dry ice to change state from a liquid or a frozen solid to a gas. And as it changes state, it displaces all the oxygen out the top of that bucket. It's got to get out. It's heavier. Imagine filling it up with something more dense, would be water, and how the water would get around the grain and push the oxygen out. Well, this gas is doing it, but only in a much lighter condition.
Okay. Well, now if I were to, say, do rice or something, I would take it out of the bag that it's in and put it in just a free form.
Right.
Okay.
Exactly.
That's how you
said put the lid on the top of this.
Well, the reason, just lay the lid.
Lay it on, okay.
As this... So when you go to put the lid on, now remember this inert gas is dense and heavy. It's not trying to diffuse out into the air, but it's not that heavy. With a little bit of breeze caused by your hand and the lid, you could push some of that away. So by just laying it there, but allowing spaces for it to so this stuff can spill out, the atmosphere can spill out, you'll get it done.
And, of course, basically what you want to do is force the oxygen out from the bottom on up. And once the inert gas gets to the top, then, of course, you can put the lid on and put it on tightly. But if you put it on tightly initially, you'll have the gas there and you'll still have the oxygen. You want to drive the oxygen out, and that's why it's done this way. Okay, Sunny?
Right. Well, now, I recently purchased one of these lids that snaps onto a 5-gallon bucket. I just got my bucket today.
Okay.
Just a try. But it snaps onto the top, but then you can untwist it.
Okay. Well, we sell a bucket that has a screw-on lid with a O-ring seal in it. It's reusable, reusable, and reusable forever.
Yeah.
It's just a real nice storage bin. It's all food-grade plastic, and... This one works very well because you can open it and close it, open and close it. You can open, take out what you need, close it back. They work really well. You can see them on our catalog, and you can call Dr. Stan and get a catalog or call us. And if any of your listeners have any questions about what I'm talking about, next week give me a call at Ready Reserve, and I'll be glad to explain this to you.
Okay, I will probably have to look at one of those buckets. The one I picked up today at Walmart just does not seem to fit my lid. So
all right, fine. Well,
I had a real tough time getting it on.
Okay,
so
fine. You can actually get these screw on. They really work really quite well. Anyway, God bless, and thanks so much.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. And I think a lot of people are just sort of mystified by all of these things. They really don't know how they would function if we didn't have all the conveniences we have. We've been spoiled. We actually carry a book called Making the Best of Basics, which gives a lot of information on how things were, 50, 75, 100 years ago, how people preserved food and did things of that sort. You need this information. Of course, it's right now. You can get the things readily through Ready Reserve Food, and they'll last for a good long time, as long as you keep them cool. That's very important, isn't it, David?
Well, like anything, it's moisture, oxygen, and heat speed up the oxidation process. So what we do is we remove two of them, and then it's your job to keep the food cool. Anything above 70 degrees really begins to accelerate the process. And our food, it's so dry, it's down on the average down around 3% total moisture. There's no such thing as too cold. You can freeze it, you can get it to 20 below, because it's not going to harm it. There's nothing, it's just heat that tends to shorten its life.
All right, fine. Well, of course, there's just so much to think about, but this is the time to begin making the preparations. And again, of course, we're talking about what does the future hold, and certainly the question is, are we really heading into the possibility of worldwide famine? Well, certainly, you know, David says his business is up, you know, tenfold here in the last few months, and I know because we've been talking intermittently through the last couple of years, and things have been awfully slow. But suddenly I think people are beginning to realize that something is very seriously wrong in America. And of course, it is wrong in America. It's wrong in the entire world. People think, oh, it's just going to be a matter of time, and everything's going to bounce back the way it was. The American dream's going to go on forever. No, I don't think so. My fear is that very, very soon the American dream may become a nightmare because, of course, God does judge nations that turn against him. And is there anybody in the audience who doubts that God, you know, would be displeased with what's going on in America, with the things that are happening right here in California where I live? Well, David, you got 3 minutes to wrap up the program.
Well, I'm just urging your listeners to step up their preparations, and you were saying that you need to start learning some of the old ways in self-sufficiency. So funny, I have a peach tree in my front yard, and it's just starting to hang heavy with peaches, even though they're not to fruition yet. But my wife and I are making plans for the first time. We're going to can those peaches this year in mason jars. We started amassing the equipment. When they come full ripe, and we're going to... We're going to put them away this year instead of give them away to the neighbors. So we have, even though, you know, I'm rather unique, I have a warehouse full of food. I won't go hungry. At least I don't think I will. But people have got to change the way they view the world around them and understand their vulnerabilities. We have a system that is extremely fragile, and it's worked marvelously to this point to bring your substance. Most people in this country today probably couldn't plant a garden without somebody showing them how. And we've come a long ways, or really degraded a long ways as a nation when it comes to just practical common sense. And earlier I talked about how most people, there's a large number of people in this country that are, their ability to think critically, this is distorted, everything is done for them, and it's distorted their abilities to think. And logically, and this is where it's taking us down the road to disaster. And your listeners are much sharper than the average bear, and they most of them will probably heed what you and I are saying and begin to look at the world differently and start stockpiling the food and to get through the winter. Stan, your parents and grandparents did. My grandparents did. My parents didn't so much. They did a little bit. Always had food in reserve in the pantry. I remember helping, as a little boy, helping my grandmother can things. She made the best grape jelly and strawberry jellies. Those ways will begin to return, but only after a bunch of, shall we say, shock and suffering in this country that no one has ever experienced.
Well, I think we're in for some very, very difficult times. Certainly, if we get into a war with Iran, certainly as the economy begins to collapse, as the price of oil continues to increase, certainly as we begin to see unrest in our cities, as people who are so used to being entitled to whatever they want to suddenly find that the government does not have the funds to provide for them, they're going to have to provide for themselves. What do you think they're going to do? Why, they're going to be out demonstrating and burning things down. It's happened in other countries. It'll happen here.
That's why I'll be on an airplane tomorrow.
Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest has been David Sibley. David, thank you so very much for being with us. It's been a real pleasure, and we always enjoy having it with us and keeping us abreast of what's going on.
Thank you.
God bless, and
thank
you so much. Well, that was David Sibley of Ready Reserve Food. Incidentally, if you'd like to get a catalog from Ready Reserve Food, give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. 1-800-544-8927. And then, of course, we would also like you to, you know, to understand that what's going on is not happening by accident. Oh, here in California, we're having very, very strange fires. We have over 1,100 fires burning in California as of today, tonight. And, of course, a lot of these, they don't have the personnel even to try to put out. They've lost an awful lot of homes. And, of course, where I live, of course, the all day long, the sky has been cloudy. The foggy, actually, you know, that this smoke is lying over this whole Monterey Bay area. Now, why is the weather changing? Well, I can't tell you for certain. I can tell you that the government has a lot of secret programs and will not let us know what's going on. But I can tell you, basically, that they do have the ability to create storms and droughts. And if you doubt that, you need to get the book written by Zygmunt Brzezinski, which we do not carry, called Between Two Ages, but somewhere between page 55 and 65. In a note at the bottom, he talks about how in the future they'll be able to create storms and droughts. And if you'd like to get those pages, we'd be glad to send them to you. But we do have a book called Weather Warfare. All the scientific facts, they know how to modify the weather. They've even signed treaties saying that they promise not to use weather warfare against the Russians. This was 1977. They had the ability to modify the weather and create storms and droughts even then. So we have a book called Weather Warfare. We have a DVD put out by our good friend Bob Fletcher on weather control, and then we have a four-tape set on weather control. We have a book called HARP, the ultimate weapon of the conspiracy. What is HARP? It's the High Altitude Auroral Research Project, a array of antennas up in Alaska where they can actually beam a billion watts of electricity, of power, up into the ionosphere, and they can alter the direction of the jet stream. Why would they want to do that? Because it would alter weather. Quite obviously, it would alter the weather and could create storms and droughts. And we know this thing is operating, but it's all operating top secret. We have a four-tape set on HARP. So we have the book, HARP, the Ultimate Weapon of the Conspiracy. We have a four-tape set on HARP. We have the book, Weather Warfare. We have a DVD on weather modification. And then we have a DVD on weather control. Pardon me, we have a four-tape, a four-CD set on weather control. All of these things are available from Radio Liberty. And if you'd like to learn more about them, give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. 1-800-544-8927. If you'd like to get that book on Making the Best of Basics, which is really a very, very sound book, and every family should have one, and hope you never need it, but if we give you the knowledge of how to prepare food, how to take care of food, what to do if you had wheat, and, of course, how you would prepare this for your family, how you would grind it, why, of course, the book is Making the Best of Basics. And then how do we put things into the perspective? I mean, we talk about the Revelation 6:8, and the quotation, the discussion there of the four horsemen of the apocalypse. Well, I believe, of course, as you know, that we're involved in a spiritual battle. You need to read my book, Brotherhood of Darkness, to get the DVD of the talk. You need, of course, to get the talk on the forbidden secret and get the syllabus that goes with that. You need to get the talk on the planned police state and get the talk, the syllabus that goes with that. And then, of course, you need to get the DVDs. They sold their souls for rock and roll. The 3-hour, the 4-hour, the 10-hour version. Our number, 1-800-544-8927. 1-800-544-8927. Our webpage, RadioLiberty.com. Go there and look at the links to all the DVDs that we put up under other videos. And then pray for America. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at. Illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that'll determine what the future will bring. And I need to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views, and, well, for the next hour, they're going to be the views of William Grigg, formerly the senior editor of the New American Magazine, and now working with the Welch Foundation, writing blogs, doing radio programs, writing books, and we carry his latest book, Liberty in Eclipse. Liberty in Eclipse, and, well, this evening, where I think we're probably going to be talking about what's happening as far as the finances of our nation, as far as the economics. Is that right, William?
Yeah, we have to talk about that, Dr. Stan. I appreciate the opportunity to be on your show again. I do think that one of the really good indications of just how imperiled what remains of our prosperity has become is the decrepitude of the dollar when it's compared against other currencies. It's being beaten consistently and embarrassingly by the euro, which is a fiat currency issued by a socialist megastate, and that megastate is still largely hypothetical. The European Union doesn't have any history before the European coal and steel community back in the 1950s, and so, of course, the European Union currency, the euro, doesn't have the decorations that adorn the dollar and other currencies, which is to say, it isn't adorned with people who have done great things or buildings that are significant or events that are significant in the history of the polity. A really good friend of mine said that the euro is decorated with pictures of people that never lived and buildings that have never been built because the European Union is still largely aspirational. But in spite of the fact that that currency is a fiat currency issued by a socialist megastate without much substance behind it, it's still consistently beating the dollar. And, of course, a number of months ago, the Canadian dollar, the so-called loonie, surpassed the American dollar, the U.S. greenback, in terms of its value. And there's a piece from just yesterday's wire services, Bloomberg service, that illustrates that even the lowly peso from Mexico is gaining strength against the dollar, and it's having a real impact on land ownership questions in Texas and some of the regions of the country that once belonged to Mexico before 1848. This Bloomberg news piece is entitled Texas Real Estate Slump Lets Mexicans Take It Back, and it starts out by saying, more than a century and a half after Mexico lost Texas to the United States, Virgilio Garza wants a piece of it back. A Texas for sale sign and cowgirls in boots and white hats greeted Garza at the Convex Center in Monterrey, Mexico earlier this month. A Monterrey developer and investor, Garza was in search of foreclosed U.S. property to buy. Texas is like our home, said Garza, 45, who joined hundreds of Mexicans pouring over lists of Texas properties at the four-day event. Garza owns manufacturing sites and other land in Mexico. He's looking to invest with his partner something like $8 million in Texas. And then the Bloomberg piece notes, a rising peso and an economy growing faster than the United States have given some Mexicans the buying power to take advantage of the housing slump in Texas. That's a really interesting observation. The peso is rising. Mexico's economy, which is much smaller than the United States economy, obviously, is growing faster than the United States economy, which is in recession. And so the correlation of forces have changed, and some people who are entrepreneurs in Mexico, as well as their incredibly corrupt corporatist and mercantilist class, now have some disposable income and some capital to take advantage of the situation by buying up parts of the United States.
But, of course, the reason that they have the money is because of American policy of
capitalism, yes,
which has actually encouraged American corporations to move to Mexico to take jobs away from here and manufacturing away from here. And this is part of the plan of the elite here. The globalist plan to create a multicultural, multilingual society by joining the United States and Mexico together and to impoverish the American people and destroy the middle class. What's happening is not accidental, ladies and gentlemen. Of course, the Mexicans are gaining wealth and we're losing wealth, and America's on the way down.
Well, this is a process I referred to in a book a couple of books back, my next to last book, which was entitled America's Engineered Decline. We're not seeing simply the natural atrophy of a state or of a society that is subject to, as all things of human construction are subject to decay. We're seeing something much more insidious than that. We're seeing the deliberate downward harmonization of the American standard of living. That's an expression you find in a lot of the literature, particularly the literature having to do with NAFTA and CAFTA and these other mercantilist, corporatist trade agreements that are not designed to encourage free trade. As you pointed out, Dr. Stan, they're designed to encourage the offshoring and the outsourcing of American industrial capacity to other countries so as to deindustrialize the United States and to create a situation where we have a population that is no longer independent. We're no longer dealing with the bourgeois, we're no longer dealing with the middle class that's independent of the political culture and the ruling elite. We're talking about people who are part of a globally fungible population of peons, of haylots, people who can be ordered hither and yon and to and fro as seems suitable in the eyes of the masters of this global economy. And when you talk about the fact that even in Mexico, which has been the beneficiary of a lot of these relocations of capital through NAFTA, and also the subsidized relocation of industrial capacity by way of loans to the Overseas Private Investment Corporation particularly, you see Mexico and the peso gaining strength against the United States. It's not so much that they're getting stronger, of course, it's that the United States is getting weaker. It's the same thing you see with respect to the price of oil and the price of a lot of other important commodities. It's not that they're getting more expensive, it's that the dollar is losing value, and so the relative, or rather the perceived impact, as far as the American consumer is concerned, is that that oil is getting more expensive. Of course, a lot of what's going on in the oil markets right now is speculation, which is being funded by the Federal Reserve. A lot of the same investment houses that were responsible for the dot-com bubble and then the housing and mortgage and refinancing bubble are pouring a lot of money into futures, oil futures speculation, driving up the price of oil in that respect. And you pointed out, Dr. Stan, that's something that could be stopped very easily in terms of the regulatory environment. And, of course, the artificial scarcity that we confront here in the United States with respect to petroleum supplies is something that could be relieved very easily. Mr. Bush could rescind executive orders signed by his father and Bill Clinton with respect to the exploration and development of oil resources within our territorial waters on the continental shelf. He could do this, George W. Bush could, simply by issuing an executive order rescinding these previous executive orders.
Hold that thought. We'll be back here in just a moment with William Grigg. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and our guest is William Grigg. William was just talking about the fact that the government really wanted to relieve the oil problems, why they would rescind the executive orders that prohibit drilling off the east or west coast of the United States. There are massive pools of oil there. An interesting article appeared within the last 10 days, and you can track this down if you have access to the Internet. Just Google in a governor of Montana, 40 billion barrels of oil. Governor of Montana, 40 billion barrels of oil. The governor of Montana has recently come out and said he believes that there are as much as 40 billion barrels of oil in his state in Montana and the adjacent Idaho. You're not going to, of course, hear that anywhere in the media. After all, there's all that oil there. Why aren't we trying to get it out? Why are we becoming increasingly dependent upon Canada and on Mexico and Venezuela and Nicaragua? And, of course, you have to understand, they don't want the American people to know there's plenty of oil out there. They've created an artificial shortage. They're running the price up, which is going to effectively, of course, impoverish our people. So go right ahead with that story, William.
That's a really good illustration of what we're talking about here, as well as the fact that there are huge oil resources and oil shale resources that have been locked out. The Copperheads Plateau in Utah, which is a treasure trove of all kinds of resources. I went there in 1996 on a fact-finding mission when I was working as a senior editor at the New American Magazine. I spent several days down there in southern Utah. This is shortly after Bill Clinton signed an executive order that foreclosed economic development of the Copperheads Plateau, which includes the parts of southern Utah and also northern Arizona. And Mr. Clinton signed this while he was at the lip of the Grand Canyon. This is back in 1995 or so, and among the resources that are not being developed because of that executive order, is a huge supply of low-sulfur coal. And when Clinton signed that executive order, it was interesting that he did this in a way that benefited the Lippo Energy conglomerate over in Indonesia, which was the only other place on Earth that had an economically accessible supply of the same type of low-sulfur coal. And so he created an artificial windfall for the Lippo conglomerate, which was one of his major campaign contributors, as we know. This whole scandal was called Chinagate, where there were laundered campaign contributions being made by a whole cast of unsavory characters with connections not only to Lippo but to the Chinese intelligence service. But when Clinton signed that executive order, he foreclosed development on the Kapierowicz Plateau, and there are all kinds of strategic minerals that are available there. People who are in the relevant industries and extracting these minerals and the coal and the other energy resources there are not entirely certain what's available, because there really hadn't been a whole lot of development. There hadn't been a lot of exploration at the time that this was all shut down by executive decree. And you have oil shale resources up in the northern United States. You have, of course, Anwar, which is smaller than a tiny postage stamp in relative terms when you take a look at the vastness of Alaska. It's much smaller than the borough of Manhattan, as a matter of fact.
When you speak of Anwar, of course, you're referring to the Arctic National Wildlife Reserve. Right?
Yes, up in Alaska. But these things have all been cast out as alternatives as a matter of primarily executive branch policy, and they can be reversed by the executive branch. Nothing's being done to do this, and so you have the artificial scarcity.
But of course, even if they were to do what they should do today, why it would be 5 to 10 years before we would have adequate oil? They've intentionally created this problem, and believe me, it doesn't matter whether we're right or whether the other side is right. Oh, peak oil, we're running out of oil. I think that's garbage. We could document that very readily if anybody wants to go to my newsletters on peak oil, September and October of 2005. But it doesn't matter that we're right and that you've been lied to. They've created a crisis, and there is no way out of it, and of course it's going to bankrupt an awful lot of our people, because they're going to have a choice between food and fuel and electricity and freezing in the winter and boiling in the summer, because they won't be able to afford the electricity. They're not going to be able to afford the gasoline for the car, for commutes or for travel or for vacations. They're going to use this to change the whole structure of our life and really, of course, to impoverish the middle class. But you go ahead, William.
Well, the impoverishment of the middle class is one obvious objective here. That's something that was discussed in terms of the energy element of the equation, the idea that there had to be this radical run-up in the price of oil that was discussed at the Bilderberg conference in Germany a couple of years ago, the idea that the price of oil, the global price of petroleum, was too low and that something had to be done to drive it up. It's interesting that that was one of the complaints made by Osama bin Laden in his fatwa of 1998 when he declared war on the United States. That's something that the Saudis have long been saying. And that's something, of course, that the Bilderberg consensus dictated a couple of years ago. But if you go back and read David Frum's memoir, The Right Man, about his time as a scriptwriter, or a speechwriter, if you will, for George W. Bush, there's a really interesting anecdote in which David Frum describes, in I think March or April of 2001, a conversation with George W. Bush in which he said that we really need to do something. I'm paraphrasing. George W. Bush said something to the effect that we needed to do something about ending the artificially low price of petroleum, and that cheap fuel had created a social situation that was unsustainable. Now, of course, Mr. Bush, who's in large measure a stranger to the proper use of the English language, wouldn't have used diction quite that elevated, but that was the essence of what he was saying. We got into a huge problem because of cheap fuel, and we have to do something about it. So you have all these apparently disparate interests, you know, George W. Bush, the Bilderbergers, the Saudis, and Osama bin Laden all saying, well, the price of oil has to come up. And so now, 7 years later, we see that the price of oil has gone up from something around less than $30 a barrel, you know, the $20 range, $20 to $30 range, in 2001, 2002, 2003, to where it's over $140 a barrel now. And that sort of thing doesn't happen naturally. That's the result of a number of factors. I mean, there's a risk premium factored into that, because there is this anticipation of a war with Iran. The war with Iraq, of course, is disturbing the consumption trends here, because keeping an expeditionary and occupation force in Iraq right now involves consuming an awful lot of refined petroleum products. It also, of course, creates dislocations and risk factors that have to be incorporated into the price of petroleum. But you also have this unchecked insider speculation that is helping to drive up the price of oil speculatively. And you also have the decrepitude of the dollar. The dollar, of course, is essaying exactly the opposite course to the price of petroleum. And so in a number of ways, you can see where there's a deliberate effort to engineer this state of affairs, and then there are things that are policy decisions that have the inevitable outcome of driving up the price of oil. You can't spend the type of money that Congress has been spending that has to be conjured into existence ex nihilo by the Federal Reserve without having radical price inflation, particularly with respect to the most important commodities, of which there are none more important than oil. And as you point out, Dr. Stan, we're going to be in a terrible situation. We already are. I mean, many people already are feeling the effects of the horrible increase in the price of energy for cooling during the summer months, and particularly in the Northeast where they had a really nasty heat wave at the beginning of the summer. There are people who have suffered terribly. And when the winter comes and energy is going to be much more expensive this winter than it is right now, people are going to be forced to make terrible decisions about what kind of adjustment they're going to make in downward harmonization of their lifestyle. If they're going to eat less, if they're going to be a little bit colder, if they're going to forego certain things that are considered to be necessities of civilized life, if they're going to have to be spending less or spending nothing at all apart from necessities. See, these are the type of choices that are frequently forced on people in the developing world, and we're largely immune to such terrible choices, but they're going to become more and more prominent in our daily lives as our standard of living is dragged down by these trends that are engineered by people who want to see us reduced to the level of helotry.
Well, I agree with you. I think we're in for some very, very difficult times, and I don't think the average American really believes that. He thinks this is just a temporary little dislocation. The price of oil is going to come down again. Everything is going to be just fine, but I'm not sure. Now, they could bring the price of oil down tomorrow, but if they did, of course, they could raise the day after that. And, of course, I think it's going to be very interesting to see what they do leading up to the election. If they want McCain in, why, of course, they'll lower the price of oil, they'll boom the stock market, and McCain will look good. If they want Obama in, the price of oil will continue up, and the stock market will continue down. And so everything is manipulated. And once you understand that, all of these things make sense. But, of course, right now they're driving up the price of oil in the process of beginning to impoverish our middle class. And I will tell you that a lot of people out there are hurting, but you go right ahead.
Well, one of the things that I've been wondering about is whether or not there's going to be a bump for McCain if we end up with a huge international crisis. There are a number of studies that I've read recently about the likely impact of a war with Iran if we see a bombing mission run by the United States or Israel or the United States and Israel in some kind of configuration against Iran, and the likely ripple effect. One of the likely ripple effects is an immediate doubling of the price of oil, and right now that would bring us into the territory of almost $300 a barrel. That would plunge the world into a depression. I don't see how that would be obviously to the benefit of the incumbent party in the White House, but there's this perception that if we end up with a huge international crisis, that we're going to see a political advantage accrue to McCain, because he is perceived for some reason as the more experienced and more sober of the candidates with respect to international affairs, although he's completely untested in international affairs and he doesn't have the disposition one would associate with sober statesmanship. On the other hand, the idea that the war with Iran that is still being held in abeyance, I'm certainly glad that it is, but that is being spoken of increasingly as an inevitability, would have the type of economic impact that would be to the benefit of the Obama campaign, because he's emphasizing the idea that we need to do something about arresting our decline into outright penury. And although his prescriptions, of course, are classic Marxism for the most part, well, sort of seasoned with a certain corporatist interest, because he is supported by a number of the same really elite investment houses that have brought about the debacle in the mortgage and refinancing sector.
Well, that's all. We'll be right back. All right, go ahead.
But I think it's interesting when you talk about Obama and McCain here, and who would be, who would enjoy, rather, the greater benefit in the event of a crisis that Mr., I believe it was Charlie Black, who was an advisor to McCain just about a week ago or so, said something to the effect that if the United States were attacked by terrorists again, if there were an attack on the on American home soil, that would be to McCain's political advantage. Now, I've often said that government is the only enterprise that actually profits through failure, and incumbency is a really strange thing. You would think that an incumbent president who had presided over the type of debacle that September 11th was, where nearly 3,000 people were killed on Tuesday morning in the United States, that the president in power at the time would be looked upon as being largely responsible for this and that he wouldn't benefit. But there's some sort of perverse reaction formation in the human psyche that leads people individually and people in the aggregate in particular to rally behind their leader when their leader, who has no more sobering responsibility than to protect the home soil from attack, has just failed to do so. And so it's interesting that Mr. Black said that about McCain, and that follows in the train of a similar comment that was made, in a broad sense it's a similar comment, by Newt Gingrich, the former Speaker of the House of Representatives, during a Long Island book signing. I believe it was either in March or May of this year. And he was asked about the fact that the Bush administration is suffering politically, and Gingrich said something to the effect of, well, that's because they're suffering the political consequences of their success in preventing terrorist attacks, and that perhaps it would have been to the political advantage of the Bush administration to allow one or two attacks to succeed just to remind the public of the stakes. Now, I can't wrap my mind around the type of a personality that would be required in order to talk so glibly about terrorist attacks that kill hundreds or thousands of innocent American citizens as a political tactic, but that's the type of people we're dealing with here. I mean, obviously, they're not all to be found on one side of the aisle or another. They're not all Republicans. They're not all Democrats. It was a Democratic president, FDR, who presided over the debacle of Pearl Harbor, knowing in detailed fashion that attack was coming and inviting it and collaborating with it in a very real sense. You know, it was a Democrat who presided over the Lusitania disaster back in the 19-teens. It was Woodrow Wilson, and you have Democrat Lyndon Johnson, who was in office during the Gulf of Tonkin charade. But you've got Republicans now who are playing the same card, the September 11th card, and all the phony so-called terrorist groups, terrorist cells that have been interdicted supposedly by the heroic FBI over the last several years. In each instance, we find that it's an FBI informant and provocateur who has actually organized the supposed plot that has been busted. They both play the same game. They use the same template. They use the same playbook. And they have the same objectives, and they take us in the same direction. They're just moderate differences in emphasis and nuance that separate McCain from Obama. And most of them have to do really with matters of window dressing and cosmetics. You know, they're both thoroughly internationalists. It's not quite as bad as in 2004 when he had a couple of cousins running for the office. George W. Bush and John Kerry were distant cousins. They're both members of the Skull and Bones Secret Society from Yale. They both answered in almost identical language that they couldn't talk about their affiliation with Skull and Bones.
Hold that thought. We'll be right back. Hold that thought. We'll be right back. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and William was just simply talking about the fact that, you know, of course, we hear about all of the terrorist attacks that have been aborted by the efficient Federal Bureau of Investigation, and then, of course, when we learn more about that, like, of course, the attempt to blow up the Sears Tower, you remember when they arrested a whole flock of Islamist terrorists who were going to blow up the Sears Tower, and then it turned out the whole thing had been contrived by the FBI and an informant who was paid fabulous sums of money to draw these people into this plot. Of course, we had an Islamist here in Northern California who had been sent over to Pakistan to learn to be a terrorist, and who sent him there? Why, an FBI informant. In fact, it is amazing, of course, that we've not had more or any serious terrorist attacks in America. It's not that they've been aborted. It is simply about the fact that most of the terrorism in America is being fomented by FBI agent provocateurs who want, of course, to draw people into this, and sometimes very foolish Muslim people will be drawn in because they find this fellow and they become their best friend, not to realize that he's a government informant there to trap them. And of course, this is the great tragedy of today. The American people believe that we're threatened by terrorism, and yet there's not been one major terrorist attack on America in the last 7 years. What's wrong with this scenario? Well, is it possible that most of what we believe has been created by the media, that the threat is not in the United States? Certainly there's a threat over in Israel. They have their suicide bombers. But why don't we have any suicide bombers here in America? Why isn't somebody out lighting forest fires all over our country? Why are they derailing trails? You would think they could find at least one suicide bomber, a radical Islamist who hates America, who would strap some explosives on him and go to into a department store, into a mall, or into a stadium. But it hasn't happened. Is it possible that this whole war on terrorism has been contrived to justify ever-increasing government control over our lives? But I'm off the track. You go right ahead there, Wayne.
Actually, I think that's very much a part of this discussion. It's very germane to the larger subject here, which is the way that politics is orchestrated, almost like kabuki theater or something like that. I do think that when you're talking about the curious absence of a follow-up of another shoe dropping after September 11th, when you hear a lot of talk radio personalities who are more or less paid publicists for the Republican Party discuss this, they always talk as if George W. Bush, the strength of his goodness and integrity, has shielded us from the myrmidons of Osama bin Laden, and that he's something, that is to say Bush, is something of a divine emperor king who needs the support of the American public and the faith and goodwill of the American public to continue holding the Mohammedans at bay. And of course, that's nonsense. I'm convinced that one of the reasons why we don't have terrorist attacks here in the United States is because the main terrorist entities responsible for carrying out attacks are basically on the payroll of the same people who are protecting us from terrorism. That is to say, it's an asset of the same entrenched elite. You can actually prove that in a lot of instances when you take a look at the creation of what is now called Al-Qaeda. That was created 30 years ago under the Carter administration by Zbigniew Brzezinski, who was a protege of David Rockefeller. He created the most acute form of the modern radical Islamist movement. And if you go back to the 1950s, you can see where the Muslim Brotherhood was being funded by and trained by the CIA. And many of the worst elements of what coalesced into Al-Qaeda had their start through subsidies from the CIA and the State Department, the Agency for International Development, and so forth. You can take a look at the domestic act, so-called terrorist cells that have been created with the help of agent provocateurs from the FBI. You see, almost without exception, where you've got people who are socially isolated and generally not terribly bright, who are brought into the orbit of somebody who's a paid informant for the FBI, and the FBI has tens of thousands of paid informants and provocateurs on its payroll that it will acknowledge in its budget requests, and probably several times more that are kept off budget. And it's almost always a case of the FBI informant provocateur saying the key things and making the significant gestures that always advance the so-called terrorist plot. And I've mentioned this before, but it bears repeating. The case of Jose Padilla, this gangbanger from Brooklyn who was arrested in Chicago in O'Hare Airport in 2002 and designated an unlawful enemy combatant by presidential decree, and then spent 3 years in military confinement where he was subjected to mental and psychological torture and physical torture as well. They were trying to create, out of Jose Padilla, an informant provocateur. That's something that came out in a testimony in Jose Padilla's criminal trial in Florida. There's one of his FBI handlers who let slip that key revelation that Padilla had been approached about becoming an undercover asset of the FBI. He was somebody who'd been a very low-caliber thug, simply a street criminal from Brooklyn, who went to prison. While in prison, he converted to Islam. That's a very common thing.
Well, that thought will be back in here in just a moment with William Grigg. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty in Williamson. We're talking about Jose Padilla, who, of course, is what his real problem was, that when he was asked to become an FBI informant, he refused to do that, saying he would not spy on his fellow Muslims, sort of like Randy Weaver, who said he wasn't going to act as an FBI informant, infiltrate the radical militia group up there in wherever he lived, Montana or Idaho. His punishment, well, of course, they conspired to get him to have an infringement. You know, they had his best friend, his FBI informant, who got him to saw off a shotgun a quarter of an inch too short. Why would they do that? Because they wanted to control him, and then when they refused to be controlled, they killed his wife, and they killed his son, and they murdered them in cold blood. And, of course, then the government wanted to convict him, and of course, when the case went to trial, wife Casey was exonerated, and they gave him $300,000 for the murder of his wife and his son. That's known as American justice, and nobody in government was ever held responsible.
Yeah. There was actually an effort, as long as we're discussing the Weaver case, which is a subject about which I have some very fiercely held opinions, being a native of Idaho. There was an attempt by the Boundary County prosecutor to prosecute Lon Horiuchi, the FBI sniper who shot and murdered Vicki Weaver, to prosecute him for murder. That was an act that took place in Boundary County, which is right up there in the tip of the panhandle, not too terribly far from the Canadian border. And Miss Woodbury, I can't remember her first name, the county prosecutor there, was very serious about getting the proper court order and retrieving Lon Horiuchi from the safety of the witness protection program in which he is now ensconced and bringing him to Idaho to stand trial for capital murder, which would have been the proper thing to do. But unfortunately, Idaho is a Republican state, and it was seen at the time as something that would have been very disadvantageous to the Republican establishment, given that this happened during the first Bush administration. The siege of Ruby Ridge here and the Randy Weaver family took place in 1992 during the closing months of the first Bush administration. And for some reason, the Republican Party establishment here in Idaho, which included Ms. Woodbury's superior, decided that they didn't want to see Lon Horiuchi stand trial. They didn't want to rock the boat. They didn't want to create the kind of trouble for the Republican Party that would be this would entail. And so they squelched this effort to have her Horiuchi prosecuted for murder.
Hold that thought. We'll be back in just a moment here. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and off air, of course, William was talking about the murder of Vicki Weaver and of Randy Weaver's son as well. Vicki Weaver was killed, was murdered by Lon Horiuchi, and of course, his excuse was, I was just carrying out orders. I was told to kill her. You know, they decided they were going to kill her. They decided that she was in charge of the family, and that they killed her, then the rest of the family would surrender. So they ordered him to kill her. He did. Now, his defense was, I was just carrying out orders. But had that ever been thought before a jury of his peers, do you think that the American people would have exonerated Lon Horiuchi? Well, the only good thing I can say is this man's life has been ruined. It should have been. He should have been tried for murder. He wasn't. He's in the witness protection team. He's been protected by our government, a known murderer. And, of course, the only reason he wasn't prosecuted is because the political pressure was put on the local prosecutor who wanted to try him for murder for intentionally killing a woman, a defenseless woman, holding a child in her hands, in her arms. Go ahead.
Yeah, and of course, in light of the fact that the federal government paid that rather sizable judgment to Randy Weaver indicates that you're dealing here with what has to be considered a criminal act. I mean, it was not a righteous shoot, in other words. It was considered what the Justice Department called an unconstitutional shot that was taken by Lon Horiuchi. And so it's a slam dunk case if you get Lon Horiuchi back into the jurisdiction of Boundary County to put him on trial for murder, but the Republican establishment here wouldn't hear of it. It's interesting. You take a look at what was done with Randy Weaver, how he was targeted for recruitment as an ATF informant, to go infiltrate the Aryan Nation community up in Hayden Lake, Idaho. And he refused to do this because Randy Weaver is an honorable guy. He doesn't want to become an informant and an agent provocateur. And you saw the same thing happen with Jose Padilla, who was a Muslim. He was recruited in prison. One of the real downsides of having the world's largest prison population is that we created a huge missionary field for Muslim missionary work. And Mr. Padilla was taken into military custody, and his mind was destroyed through psychological manipulation and torture, and apparently the use of psychotropic drugs, because he refused to become an agent provocateur.
So I guess that the lesson to be learned is if the government comes to you and asks you to become an informant on your friends or to destroy your friends, why, you better go along with them or they'll do the same thing to you.
That apparently is what they want us to learn. It's a sobering thing. It's a very common thing, unfortunately. There's a piece I wrote about, and I'm sure that this is something that your listeners would be familiar with if they looked at your material, Dr. Stan, and that's the case of Kenneth Tredadue, who was beaten to death in a federal holding facility in Oklahoma City just a few months after the Oklahoma City bombing. His brother Jesse is an attorney in Salt Lake City. He's been trying to find out what happened. Why was Kenny Tredadue beaten to death? He'd been on parole for a number of years, and had violated his parole in a stupid technical sense. He wasn't permitted to drink, in spite of the fact that he'd never been an alcoholic. He'd gone to jail in the 1980s for robbing a bank, and when he came out, he went straight. He got married. He started a new life. He was a construction worker, and his parole officer, in spite of the fact that there was nothing in Kenny Trinity's background that would suggest a tendency toward alcoholism, said that Kenny couldn't drink. And in spite of that, Kenny Trinity would have the occasional beer. He was never an alcoholic. He was never drunk. I don't think he ever had a DUI on his driving record. But after the Oklahoma City bombing took place, Kenny Trinity came back from a visit to Mexico. He was visiting his in-laws down there. And on his way back through customs, his name was flagged by the computer system because he was in violation of his parole. And so he was taken into custody, and he figured that, well, he's probably going to have to go to jail for a period of time or serve a term of community service, so there was going to be some kind of a consequence, some kind of a penalty. But he found himself in the hands of the FBI, and he was taken back to Oklahoma City, and then he was beaten to death. He was beaten so badly he was completely unrecognizable. His throat was slit very deeply by a garrote, most likely an improvised garrote made out of the plastic zip cuffs that are used to restrain criminal suspects. The way it works out is that Kenny Tredadue looked like and had basically the same background as somebody who was already in the system, who was a member of a white supremacist group called the Aryan Republican Army that was involved in bank robberies that were being used to fund various kinds of domestic insurrectionary and insurgent-type activities by the white supremacist underground. And one of the people that had been involved in the Aryan Republican Army was none other than Timothy McVeigh. Timothy McVeigh had several contacts in the ARA, who'd been involved in the planning and execution of the Oklahoma City bombing. And many of the people who were associated with that group were also associated with this bizarre little commune down in Oklahoma called Elohim City, which was a white supremacist, a little white supremacist sect, a little white supremacist cell, rather. It was presided over by a guy by the name of Robert Millar. Robert Millar was an outspoken white supremacist who championed domestic terrorism.
He was also an FBI
agent. He was also an FBI informant.
In fact, most of the people there at Elohim City were working for the FBI.
They were all working for one federal agency or another. The most notable of the group there was Carol Howe. She was an informant for the ATF who did some heroic work in terms of exposing and offering advance warning of the plot to bomb the Oklahoma City federal building.
And that's, of course, where they wanted to send her to prison to silence her, and they would have sent her to prison for 20 years Here was a patriotic woman who infiltrated, risked her life to protect America, and they contrived evidence against her, and they would have sent her to prison if her family hadn't, of course, been able to hire an excellent lawyer. In fact, we have an interview with that lawyer. It's one of our four tape sets on Oath to Oklahoma City. And he got Carol Howe off.
Yes.
You know, otherwise, they would have sent her to prison knowing that she was innocent, but they just wanted it to. They had to suppress the information she had about Elohim City, because of course it tied right back into the government and their involvement in what happened at Oklahoma City and the death of all those American citizens.
Well, you know, the thing that I find most remarkable of the Carol Howe affair here is that they burned her. In other words, she was already an outed agent. Now, an agent is somebody who's run by an intelligence agency. An operative is somebody who actually works for the agency, but an agent is somebody recruited who's not part of the agency, who does something by way of providing intelligence or information. She was already burned by the time they sent her back after the bombing into Elohim City. Seems to me they were trying to get her killed right then. I mean, what happens when an agent is exposed is that a document called a burn notice is filed, and that agent is taken out of circulation because he or she is no longer of any use. Once the cover is blown, you might as well just find something else for that person to do because he or she can no longer be a spy. Well, Carol Howe's cover was blown after Oklahoma City, and they sent her back anyway. And then a little more than a year and a half later, 2 years later, they tried to put her in prison on completely spurious charges, knowing that once she got into the general prison population, it'd be a really simple move.
You're tuned to the Global Star Radio Network. Thanks for listening.
I'm just getting into the beat, man. It's Friday.
That is not necessarily a good thing for Dave.
That's a digga zigga chugga zigga. Anyway, good morning. Yeehaw. Good afternoon. Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, wherever you're situated on this great, big, beautiful blue globe floating in the void of Yah's creation. Take a deep breath. It's